We're going to have a great encouragement as we look in Proverbs chapter 5. Now, a painter will often use a contrast with a dark background to bring out the beauty and the brilliance of the color in the painting. So here, the beauty of purity is set against the black backdrop of lust and self-fulfillment. The sweet joys of marital love are contrasted by the cheap, short-lived, passing pleasures of sin. And as we look at this poetic language, of course, we're in the poetry of the Bible here in Proverbs, all the way from Job to Ecclesiastes. You've got the five poetical books. The poetry, the language is very picturesque. In fact, it's so much so that we have to be careful of looking too closely at some of these deep things of Satan, because there is, even in the description of them, can arouse passions in our flesh. I know as a young man, reading some of the exhortations that Solomon gave to his son to keep away from the lust of the flesh. You're reading some of the descriptions, and even when you're trying, Lord, keep your heart pure, brings out even more passions. But there's an assumption made here. The assumption is we're weak, and we need to keep a safe distance from the swirling current that can suck us in. Even as Jesus said, a man who looks after a woman with lust in his heart has already committed adultery. There is that picture. So let's see what he has here. He says, my son, pay attention to my wisdom. Lend your ear to my understanding. Now, he will remind his son quite frequently. In fact, he already covered the subject in chapter 2, and now he's going to hit it in chapter 5, and of course in chapter 6, and chapter 7, and then in chapter 9. A very similar message about the warning of the lust of the flesh here. He says, my son, pay attention. So I'm going to exhort you this morning. Pay attention. No sleeping. Keep close attention, because Solomon has some things to really instruct us. Lend your ear to my understanding, he says, that you may preserve discretion and your lips may keep knowledge. Now, why is that important? Well, because you're going to run into some other types of lips in the next verse that you're going to have to be aware of. He says that he wants your lips to keep knowledge because the lips of an immoral woman drip honey. Notice the poetic language, the picturesque language. And her mouth is smoother than oil. But in the end, and that's the key, you see, this is the issue for us as Christians. We see the end result of things. Oh, if we could only see the end result of all of our decisions, how it would change them. If we could see what will happen if I do this, 5 years from now, what will be the repercussions? And if I could see that, I go, oh, I better not do that. And I get an understanding just by considering the end. And so this is why we learn. Now, you can learn by experience. Some people think learning by experience is the best way to learn. Well, it's certainly an effective way to learn. I wouldn't call it the best way to learn, though. See, a wise person can learn from somebody else's experience. And hence, we have the Bible to give us the examples to learn by. Like Samson, who gave us a great example not to follow, as he played too close to the edge with his passions. And look where it brought him. But we can learn from other people's examples. If you had to learn everything by experience, that's a very expensive way to learn, wouldn't you say? It's a hard way to learn. Benjamin Franklin, didn't he say experience is a dear teacher? And I hear teachers sometimes telling their students, experience is a dear teacher, as if to say that means good. No, dear in the old English meant expensive. It's an expensive way to learn, to have to learn things the hard way by experience yourself. Rather, listen. As your lips keep knowledge, it will preserve you from the lips of an immoral woman who drip honey, and her mouth is smoother than oil. But notice, in the end, she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps lay hold of hell. Lest you ponder her path of life, her ways are unstable. You do not know them. Therefore now, my children. And he gives the instruction. Now, I love how Solomon, at least he introduces it, and then he gives us an understanding of how to keep clear, how to be wise. And the first thing he tells us, he says, hear me now, my children. Now, he's reminding them, listen, pay attention. The first thing we need to do as Christians in confronting any type of temptation is to remind ourselves what is true, what is right. We've got to tell ourselves. No one will tell it for you. We've got to remind ourselves what's right in that moment, because it's not going to be easy. Temptation is designed in such a way, Satan knows your weaknesses. He knows your tendencies. He knows your propensity for whatever it is. And he lays that snare. He puts that in front of you. But if you remember, if you remind yourself what is true, you won't fall after that. How many people have fished? Have you ever fished? Anybody? Okay. Now, when you fish, you're lying to those poor little fish. Did you know that? I mean, it's a lie. You're saying to that fish, here's a nice little morsel of food just for you. Well, if that fish, now what happens? If the fish believes the lie, what's he going to do? He's going to bite it, and what will happen? He's hooked. When we believe a lie, we're hooked. When we believe the illusion of what the world paints as what's going to give us fulfillment and happiness and light, and we go after filling our own, you know, lusts, we get hooked. We don't get fulfillment. We get sucked into a current that brings us under and drowns us. And it traps us. It snares us. So we've got to realize the truth, remind ourselves, realize what's right. Don't forget. He says, do not depart from the words of my mouth. Have that truth. And Jesus says, you'll know the truth and the truth will set you free. This is how we can escape, number one. Secondly, he says, remove your way. Not only do we need to remind ourselves, but we need to remove your way, he says, far from her. Do not go near the door of her house. Now, this is just common sense. You know, if you know what wares this woman has to offer and you know your weakness, why would you even be there? It makes me amazed why Eve just happened to be under that very tree that she was commanded not to eat of. What is it about human nature? We're drawn to that thing that we can't have. Stolen water is sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant. There's that attractiveness to that which we cannot have. So remove yourself. Keep away. Know your weakness. Now the strong thing, I can handle it. It doesn't affect me. You know, that doesn't really bother me that much. I'm strong. I can handle that. Famous last words. Because they think they're strong. And they go on, the proud go on thinking that they can handle it. But the weak, they say, Lord, I need help. And they're protected. So remove your way. Don't go near. Verse 9, he says, lest you give your honor to others and your years to the cruel one. Now he begins to outline some of the costs involved of going that way. Realize the cost. So remind yourself the truth. Remove your way. Keep away. Flee. You know, Joseph, he had to run when he was tempted. He couldn't just stand around. And even though Potiphar's wife grabbed him by the garment, he squirmed out of the garment and ran out naked. Even to have to run out naked, run. But he got out of there. And then thirdly, realize the cost. Notice, lest you give your honor to others. What happens to your reputation when you sin in a scandalous sin of this nature? It takes a lifetime to build a good reputation, and one stupid act can bring it all down. One dumb move. So understand that. Why would you want to give your honor to others and your years to the cruel one? Look what happened to Samson as he's there now blinded as they put his eyes out and he's grinding like a brute beast, the mill, grinding the corn there for years because of his sin. And notice, and your labors go to the house of a foreigner, and you mourn at last. Now, or lest the aliens be filled with your wealth, and your labors go to the house of a foreigner. Verse 10. Now, your reputation, yes, but also your wealth. How many families have been divided because of sexual sin? Homes broken up because of infidelity. And then the payments come, and the money's exchanged, and the lawyers walk off with most of it. And that's a sad situation to people who cannot keep their passions. Their wealth goes to others. And then notice, and you mourn at last when your flesh and your body are consumed. Not only does it affect your reputation and your wealth, but also your health. Your very health. You know, I don't think Solomon would have phrased it in the same way we would. You know, we can look at the statistics on sexually transmitted diseases and see it's a sad plight. It's more widespread than people have any idea. But they don't understand what the end result of those sexually transmitted diseases are. See, God made our bodies very fascinating. When a foreign protein or bacteria is introduced into our body, our bloodstream builds up antibodies to that. And they deal with that foreign protein and that bacteria. And then whenever that comes again, it's already set and your body can handle it. It doesn't overtax your immune system. But when you have multiple partners, let's understand, even if just one other partner, it's not the one other partner that you have to build immunities to, but the partners they've been with and all the partners they've been with and all the partners they've been with. So your body now is overloaded. Your immune system is overtaxed. And hence, you end up getting some type of an STD, and it could be very serious. Point is, God created us, obviously, for one person. When we overtax our immune system, then our health goes down. And notice, you mourn at last when your flesh and body are consumed. And say, now notice the fourth issue here, the regrets. You say, how I have hated instruction and my heart despised correction. I didn't want to listen. I knew better than anybody. And I have not obeyed the voice of my teachers, nor inclined my ear to those who instructed me. I was on the verge of total ruin in the midst of the assembly and congregation. There this person was a churchgoer, following God, but flirted a little too close to the edge, and now on the verge of total ruin. How can it happen? Do you think it can't happen to you? It can happen to you. How many times it begins with just a little flirtation at the office, or a little discontentment at home. And then you're on the prowl, you're looking, you know, for someone else to satisfy your needs. But the answer really, when the Lord gives these horrible negatives to look at, he doesn't want to leave us thinking that. He wants to give us the real truth, the real picture of what marital love should be like. He says, drink water from your own cistern and running water from your own well. The idiom there is obvious. Be content with that which you have. Should your fountains be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets? Let them be only your own and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of your youth. You know, this is a choice that you make. When you're married, you make a choice to be satisfied with your mate. You see, the foundation is commitment. And that satisfaction comes built on commitment. Now, I think it was George Bernard Shaw who once said of the vows people make at a wedding, his view was quite cynical. He said, when two people are under the influence of the most violent, most insane, most delusive, and most transient of passions, they are required to swear that they will remain in that excited, abnormal, and exhausting condition continuously until death do them part. Obviously had an attitude toward commitment. But that's why we make vows, you see. The understanding is our feelings may come and go. So the vow, the commitment, assumes that. That's why you make it. If it was all about feelings, then you wouldn't have to make a vow or a commitment, would you? But that's the foundation. The excitement, the passion will rise up and go down, rise up and go down. But the commitment remains same, and it's the foundation of which to build. See, rejoice with the wife of your youth. As a loving deer and a graceful doe, let her satisfy you at all times and always be enraptured with her love. You can read it yourself. But the point is this. God created that. He's the one that created sex. He's the one that created the pleasure. He had it in mind. The problem is when you choose to not let your wife or your husband, as is the case, satisfy you. You're now in a dangerous place now, because now you're open to all the feelings you might have to go in directions that will eventually bring you down and cause a world of hurt and pain to not only yourself but others around you. We've got to understand this. It's the foundation here. Why should you, my sons, he says, be enraptured by an immoral woman and be embraced in the arms of a seductress? Why should you let it go? Why should you let your fountains be dispersed in the street? Why should you not take that foundation and say, all right, here I am committed? And you know, out of that commitment, I know in our younger years of marriage, my wife and I, you know, you have heated arguments and everyone goes through those times. And, you know, then your words say things that you regret. And one particular argument, it came to a point where, you know, we mentioned the D word, the divorce. And you know, the amazing thing is after we did that, there was a lot of hurt. It took some time to really get over that pain. And we made a commitment at that point. We will never utter that word again. No matter how heated the argument, no matter how much the battle, no matter how much we disagree, that word is out of our vocabulary. It's not there. And you know what? What a difference. You see, what we did was we had a foundation and we built a strong block on that foundation. No D word. And there might be other things you need to make a commitment. Okay, let's not go here. Let's not go here. Let's not do this. Let's never say this. And you've got a foundation now built, and you know there's a safety net there. Because now you trust in each other's commitment. And there's a warmth there that comes. And then there's that understanding you're brought near. And there's nothing like that commitment in marriage. The world can ape it all it wants to try, but it cannot truly come up with it. Because it can only exist in the way that God has designed. And people are trying to find some fleeting feeling to match it, and it can't happen. For the ways of man, he goes on to say, are before the eyes of the Lord. And he ponders all his paths. See, one of the things that you've got to understand about any sin is that we do it in secret, don't we? We don't want anyone to know. We don't want to advertise it. We put it under a cover of darkness. But the ways of man are before the eyes of the Lord. He sees. He knows. We can't hide anything from him. And he ponders all his paths. I always think in terms of any temptation that comes. And not only does the Lord see, but all those that have gone before in heaven see. And those who are in the situation now will one day see, because everything's going to be shouted from the housetops. And so it's like just a motivation to say, you know what, I don't need this. The Lord knows. Notice his own iniquities entrap the wicked man, and he's caught in the cords of his own sin. You know, the very punishment for sin is built within the sin itself. You get trapped by the very sin that you've enjoyed. And he shall die for lack of instruction, and in the greatness of his folly he shall go astray. I don't know if Solomon had in mind the pagan mythology of his day of the Canaanites. The god Mot, or Death, was a Canaanite deity which controlled the long winter in their idea. And if Baal, their god, was to conquer it, it would necessitate a ritual of a sexual nature which would encourage Baal to have relations with the goddess Anat and thus fertilize the land for the spring. The irony is this. Doing the things in rejection of God's law brought death, not life, as the Canaanites supposed. When you go your own way and you follow the dictates of your own heart as opposed to what God has described, which is right, you're going to find something very interesting. Instead of the joy and the peace and the life that you anticipated, you get nothing but death. It's emptiness in the end. He'll die for lack of instruction. Now, Solomon gives a few other exhortations that are repeated later on in the Proverbs, so we're not going to spend a lot of time in them, so we can get right back to the subject at hand in the next chapter. He says, my son, if you become surety for your friend, if you've shaken hands in a pledge for a stranger, you're snared by the words of your mouth, and you're taken by the words of your mouth, so do this, my son, and deliver yourself. For you have come into the hand of your friend. Go and humble yourself. Plead with your friend. Give no sleep to your eyes, nor slumber to your eyelids. Deliver yourself like a gazelle from the hand of the hunter, and like a bird from the hand of the fowler, or the person who would catch birds. Now, what is he saying here? We don't use the word surety very often, but basically you've become a guarantee for your friend. You've co-signed a loan, for example. Now, there's nothing wrong with co-signing a loan if you know your friend has the wherewithal to pay the loan and they just don't have a credit rating. But you got to be careful, you see here, because there might be another situation that you're not aware of. Your friend can't pay his bills. That's why he needs you. Now you become surety. Or you've shaken hands and pledged for a stranger. In other words, you've pledged yourself to help someone that you don't even know whether they're going to fulfill that pledge. Not very wise. Why would a person do that? Why would you go down that road? Why would you guarantee for a stranger? Well, in the emotion of the moment, you didn't want to look like a cheapskate, so you made a promise. You said something, I'll take care of it. You can pay me back. And so now, by your words, you've made a commitment, you've pledged yourself, you become surety for a friend. Now, you've been taken by the words of your mouth. Maybe it was pride. You wanted to be thought well of. Now you got to keep your word. See, now the problem is if you have a friend that needs something, or if there is a stranger that is in need, you've got to understand the extent that you can help them is the extent that you're willing just to lose it all. Because if you are banking your credit line and your life on them keeping their word, you put yourself in a vulnerable position. You should only help to the extent that you can afford to completely lose. That's wisdom. Otherwise, you're going to be in trouble. And if you do get in trouble, he gives you a remedy here. If you're taken by this promise, now people make promises all the time, and maybe you don't understand what the big deal is here, because people make promises and they break them all the time. But in that culture, it was quite different. God takes a very serious view of our word. In Psalm 15, he says, "He who swears to his own word and changes not, it is he who will abide in the presence of God." In other words, you've sworn something, and now even if it hurts to keep it, you're going to keep your word. That's the type of man and woman God will honor. But you know, people say things all the time. "Hey, I'll be there." And they don't show up. "Oh, I've signed, you know, I'll do it. Or I'll give you this." And they don't keep their word because it's cheap. That's not the way it should be. Understand, when you make a promise, when you speak your word, you know, your character, your reputation is only as good as your word. But if you have made that type of a commitment, there's a way to get out of it. The only thing you can do is you've got to get them to release you. You've got to humble yourself in front of them, plead with your friend, give no sleep to your eyelids nor slumber to your eyes until you get out of that situation, and that you've got to get them to release you. Second thing he says here is verse 6. He says, "Go to the ant, you sluggard." Now he talks about other... So these are types of pride and laziness. And in the next thing, we'll see just plain, you know, premeditated evil are all a part of this heart that's warped on self, that is susceptible to the other dangers of filling its lusts. Here he says, "Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider your ways and be wise, which having no captain, overseer, or ruler, provides your supplies in the summer, gathers your food in the harvest." Now, some of the old-time Bible critics from 100 years ago used to mock the Bible in this, saying, well, here you just have the Bible making all these crazy things, you know, saying ants are actually gathering and supplies, and they're gathering grain in and they're storing it for the winter. That doesn't happen. They see ants just grabbing little pieces of meat, they're carnivores. They didn't see how this could fit. Of course, now we know, when you watch the nature shows, you know ants are quite more organized than you would imagine. They do. They go out on hunting forays and they bring back their food, but they also do bring back grain. And they also even cut little plants off. Have you ever seen the one where they trim the little leaves and they bring them down in their den and they grow a mold? They're actually farmers. These ants are farmers. They're farming mold on this particular plant, and then they eat the mold. Others actually are farming little aphids. You know, little aphids are protected by them in exchange for a little sweet treat that the aphid will give the ant. Fascinating little creatures. But the key is they're busy. They're busy, busy, busy. How long? He says, "Will you slumber, O sluggard? When will you rise from your sleep?" A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. "So your poverty shall come on you like a prowler, and your need like an armed man." Now, how does a prowler come? Prowlers come in sneaky. They sneak up on you. You didn't know they were there, and then you all of a sudden, "Oh man, look, I'm missing something." That's how your poverty will come. You'll think, "Hey, it's okay. I can take a break. I'll take an extended vacation. I don't have to work. I can enjoy myself right now." And you don't see poverty slipping up on you. And then, of course, your need will take you like an armed man. Now, how does an armed man come in? Well, an armed man comes in with, you know, force. Now your need is taking you by force. A worthless person, a wicked man, walks with a perverse mouth. He winks with his eyes, shuffles his feet, and points with his fingers. Now, those idioms then had... You know, obviously something was involved in hiding your true intention. And these are types of little body signals you're giving to someone else to hide the intention of the person that you're saying something to. But perversity is in his heart. He devises evil continually. He sows discord. He's out for himself. "Therefore his calamity shall come suddenly. Suddenly he shall be broken without remedy." This is the scariest thing about being a wicked person. You're sliding down the easy path. You've got some schemes and some scams that have made you rich, and everything's going great. But suddenly you're broken without remedy. When you choose a dangerous path like that, one day it will all come to an account. Now, these six things the Lord hates. Yes, seven are an abomination to him. Really, seven things the Lord hates. What does the Lord feel about certain things? Well, he tells you right here how he feels about these. But you know, the amazing thing about this list is, I would have to agree, I hate the same things. I hate them in you. I don't necessarily hate them in me. That's how we are in nature, isn't it? You know, when we see someone doing these things, we hate it. We loathe it. But if it's in ourselves, well, there's an excuse. Notice what God hates. And you know, you have to agree. You hate the same thing. A proud look. There's nothing more disgusting than some haughty person who thinks they're all that when they're not all that. You know, that proud look. Or a lying tongue. We hate that, and others do it. Now, of course, when we lie, you know, it was a tough situation. I didn't mean to. We have an excuse for it. But when someone else lies to us, how dare they? Hands that shed innocent blood. Someone taking an innocent person's life. You know, we'd hate that. There's something just within us that cries up against that when we see those innocent people dying, that we hate that. A heart that devises wicked plans. Premeditated evil. They're conniving and scheming on how to devise something evil. Feet that are swift in running to evil. They're all too quick to go the easy path instead of the hard path that's right. They're quick to go down the easy path. And a false witness who speaks lies. Again with a lying. And one who sows discord among the brethren. So the six things the Lord hates, seven are an abomination. He repeats lying twice as if to express that as even the most odious things. And of course, Satan, what is he known as? The father of what? Lies. One who sows discord. Now, notice how all the members of our body are involved in this. The proud look involves the eyes, the lying, the tongue, the hurting the innocent, the hands, the heart, premeditated evil, the tongue again, or the feet easily swayed by evil, the tongue twice again. So you've got the tongue mentioned three times here. Three out of the seven are involved in that little piece of flesh between your nose and your chin. Our biggest trouble. Our biggest problem. But you could also make an interesting comparison of these things with the Sermon on the Mount. See, what did Jesus say? Blessed are the poor in spirit. Contrast that with the proud look. Blessed are the peacemakers. You can contrast that with the one who devises wicked plans or sows discord among the brethren. These things are contrasted by that true blessedness the Lord can give to us. So these things that Solomon brings, now again he gets back to the subject at hand and keeping pure. He says, my son, keep your father's command and do not forsake the law of your mother. Bind them continually upon your heart. Tie them around your neck. When you roam, they'll lead you. When you sleep, they'll keep you. And when you awake, they'll speak with you. Do you see a little bit of diligence that a person must have in the Word of God? You know, if you're not diligent in reading the Bible to spend some time letting God speak to you in the morning, how in the world do you think you're going to have wisdom and strength to withstand the many temptations throughout the day? Do you think you're strong enough? Do you really think you can do it? I mean, I'll tell you, I've been a pastor for 20 plus years, and I've studied the Bible, I've read through it from cover to cover, I don't know how many times. But I'm afraid of my own self for one day if I don't spend time meditating in the Word, or at least considering. It's so easy just to open the newspaper or do something else, and then I find I don't have the wisdom when I need it. Bind it around your neck, he says. For the commandment, this is why you make the commitment to read through the Bible in a year, and you got the reading program back there in the foyer. Do it. Make it a priority in your life. Do you do it for God? God, look at me, I'm reading your Bible, now bless me. No. You do it for you. You realize you need to have an understanding. He says, for the commandment is a lamp and the law is a light. Reproofs of instruction are a way of life. I tell you, every time I read the Bible, the Lord will reproof me about some attitude I've had or something. And man, it keeps my marriage fresh. It keeps my being a father to my children fresh. It keeps my ministry with leaders fresh. He says, to keep you also from the evil woman. We come back to this woman here. From the flattering tongue of a seductress. Do not let lust after her beauty in your heart, nor let her allure you with her eyelids. You know, interesting story. When I was a young pastor in California, I was locking up, saying goodbye to a friend from in the parking lot, and there was a girl in between us who caught my eye, and she said, she came over to introduce herself. She says, hi, I'm April. And I was just kidding around. She says, hi, I'm May, you know. And, I went to give her the Christian hug, you know, respectful pat on the back and stuff. Actually, I shook her hand, but she was going for a hug, so I gave her the Christian hug. And then she pulled me right into herself. And I was kind of shocked. I was taken back for a second, and then I looked for a moment at her eyes. And it was weird. It was almost satanic. It was the strangest thing. It was like I couldn't even look at her eyes. I just turned away, and I couldn't even say anything. I just walked away. Later, I wanted to try to confront her because I knew if she was doing that to me, she might be doing that to other guys. And it's only a matter of time before she brings somebody down. But I never saw her after that. But boy, then I read this in the Proverbs, and I thought, don't let her eyelids allure you. Well, I thought, wow, that is so real. That was so true in that moment. It was almost satanic. But don't lust after her beauty, he says. Notice, for by the means of a harlot, a man is reduced to a crust of bread, and an adulteress will prey upon his precious life. You know, you might have found yourself depressed before you became a Christian. And of course, being depressed, no one really wants you around. I mean, you're not the life of the party, let's face it, when you're depressed. And you're not in great demand socially when you're depressed. And so you're going through this depression, this weight of guilt and all this stuff, and then you come to Jesus and he just lightens your eyes up again. He frees you so much. He's given you that joy, and now your countenance has changed, and your old friends see you and they go, hey, how you doing? Now you're in demand. Now they want you back at the parties. Now they want you back. Hey, come on. And you get a lot more temptations now. You find the Lord has made you something valuable. And now, notice, people around want to prey upon that precious life, just as this adulteress will prey upon his precious life. Can a man take fire into his bosom and his clothes not be burned? You know, God created sex. It's a beautiful gift. It's a fire that gives warmth and light into a relationship. But put it in the living room rug and see what happens. It's not where it's meant. It's meant to be in the fireplace, not in the living room rug. It's meant for marriage. You can't take fire in your bosom and your clothes not be burned. Can one walk on coals and his feet not be seared? So is he who goes into his neighbor's wife. Whoever touches her shall not be innocent, or literally, go unpunished. It's going to cost you. Now, verse 30, he says, people don't despise a thief if he steals to satisfy himself when he's starving. Yet when he's found, he must restore sevenfold. You know, the Levitical law actually is you restore 20%. You restore what you stole and plus 20%. But human tradition made it sevenfold, made it even tougher. So you steal something, now you got to give seven times back. Now, even if you don't feel, you know, like you hate the guy because you know he was hungry, you might even give him something to eat, but he's still going to pay back what he stole. It's just. But whoever commits adultery with a woman lacks understanding. He who does so destroys his own soul. Wounds and dishonor he'll get, and his reproach will not be wiped away. For the jealousy of a husband, jealousy is a husband's fury. Therefore, he will not spare in the day of vengeance. He will accept no recompense, nor will he be appeased, though you give him many gifts. Now, can you imagine committing adultery with somebody's wife? And then whipping out your checkbook, you know, how much do I owe you for that? You know, I feel bad. You know, what would you want me to write? Okay, will that work? Of course not. You're dealing with something so precious and sacred as a relationship. No amount of money can appease that. No amount can restore that friendship. It is done. I've seen this destroy so many people's lives. Now, interesting, you got the harlot out there, the prostitute that's, you know, making a living and luring you in for her business. But then you've got the neighbor's wife. You know, someone that you know, someone that you know her husband, and you play with their kids and your families have shared time together. And now you're putting a make on her wife and she's putting a make on you. And the next thing you know, you're in an adulterous relationship because you flirted around with it. And boy, you don't know what it's going to cost you. He says, my son, keep my words and treasure my commands within you. Keep my commands and live. My laws is the apple of your eye. Bind them on your fingers. Write them on the tablet of your heart. Say to wisdom, you're my sister, and call understanding your nearest kin, that they may keep you from the immoral woman, from the seductress who flatters with her words. Why all this repetition? Because that's how we learn. Why is it so important that he keeps driving this point home? Because this is one of our weakest areas. The mantra of the advertising world is two words: sex sells. It's a powerful allurement. It's something that is, you know, age old. The desires the Lord has given to us, but God has created those desires for the place that they need to be in marriage. When you go outside of marriage, when you fornicate as a single or you commit adultery as a married person, you don't know the hurt that you're doing to yourself. When you sin in this way, you're sinning against your own body. And it does have repercussions. So this is why he keeps warning. Now, this is not just for guys in the sense of pornography, too. You know, there are women that get caught up in the romance novels. They start fantasizing of all these, you know, with the sitcoms and or with the types of movies, that the romance movies that really bring this real romantic flair. And then they long after that, and it's an unreal world that they're longing after, and they're never going to be satisfied. Reality can never match fantasy, but reality is real. What you can fantasize is always more exciting than real life. But you know what? It's like the Technicolor dreaming. You cannot live it. It's unreal. It's an illusion. You've got to choose to be content with what God has given you. If you're single, wait on Him. He has a great plan, but you're short-circuiting that plan when you satisfy yourself. When you're married, He's given you a wife or a husband. Choose to enjoy that relationship. Be committed. Set that foundation strong. Even if right now, I want to tell you this, even right now, there may be some couples here that are literally at each other's throats, that you despise each other, and you're just so angry, you're not even talking to each other. I want to tell you something. If you're willing to humble yourself and be what God has called you to be as a husband or as a wife, God's promises to you are not to couples, but to individuals. He'll give you that peace and that joy. And then when He fills you, when He fills one of you, guess what's going to happen? It's going to influence the other. And you're going to see something happen. Who's going to start? Who's going to be the one that wants to go God's way? He goes on to tell us this amazing story. It's a picture of what happened to a young man. He says, "At the window of my house, I looked through my lattice, and I saw among the simple. I perceived among the youths a young man, devoid of understanding, passing along the street near her corner, and he took the path to her house. In the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night." You see, it's always under cover of darkness. You know, we should learn a few things about ourselves. When we stay up late at night, there's nothing really worthwhile on the TV. And it only creates more opportunities for just mind wandering, lust, things that happen in the evening. You know, I'll tell you, there's a lot to be said for morning people. And if more people were morning people, we could probably get more of you out to first service, too. Anyway, that's beside the point. There is a lot to be said about the darkness, and that's where we hide things. And there a woman met him, and with the attire of a harlot and a crafty heart. Now, she is not a harlot. She has the attire of a harlot. But you'll find that she's not a harlot in a few verses. She was loud and rebellious. Her feet would not stay at home, so she has a home. At times she was outside, at times in the open square, lurking at every corner. So she's a very popular woman. She has a home, she has a husband. So she caught him and kissed him, and with an impudent face said to him, "I have peace offerings with me. Today I've paid my vows. So I came out to meet you diligently to seek your face, and I have found you." Now, is the you someone just opportunistic that she found, or is it someone that she has thought about a lot of getting? The other thing that strikes me is that here is not just it's not a harlot. This is a woman. She has a home. She's got a husband. She's even a religious girl. She's paid her vows. She's has peace offerings. These are the language of someone that was a person that was going to the church. In fact, did she just come from church? You know, is it possible, and I believe it is, that sometimes people treat church as almost like a penalty box for their evil? Okay, I've been in the penalty box for enough time, now I can go out and do my thing. They treat church like, well, I hope this isn't a penalty box for you. Because if you just come here just to feel bad because, you know, you've done wrong and you've got to feel that guilt because you think you're atoning for your sin by feeling guilt, that is very self-deceptive. There's only one thing that can atone and cover for your sin, and that's the blood of Jesus. Walking in a relationship with Him. Knowing Him. And then not only does He forgive it, He empowers you to overcome it. But here's the woman. She doesn't know this true love of God. She's looking to fill that emptiness in her heart, and so she's fantasized about this guy, and now she's found him, and she says, I spread my bed with tapestry, colored linens of Egyptian linen. I perfume my bed with myrrh and aloes and cinnamon. Come, let's take our fill of love until morning. Let us delight ourselves with love, for my husband is not at home. He has gone on a long journey. He has taken a bag of money with him and will come home on the appointed day. Look at how beautiful the language, colored linens of Egyptian linen, coverings and perfumed and myrrh and aloes and cinnamon. The language is very poetic. It's actually borrowed from Song of Solomon, which was meant for the marriage bed. Now she's bringing this other man in it. And notice verse 21. With her enticing speech, she caused him to yield. With her flattering lips, she seduced him. Immediately he went after her as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as a fool to the correction of the stocks. Till an arrow struck his liver, as a bird hastens to the snare, he did not know it would cost his life. Where will it end? Where it begins is always beautiful looking. Temptation is always appealing. If it weren't appealing, we wouldn't be tempted. We're all tempted. We all go through. I mean, I don't trust my flesh. My flesh will always be just as evil as it's always been. I want to walk in the Spirit, and that's the key. He doesn't know what it's going to cost him. He's got to remind himself of what is right. He doesn't do it. He yields. Now therefore listen to me, my children. Pay attention to the words of my mouth. Do not let your heart turn aside to her ways. Do not stray into her paths, for she has cast down many wounded. And notice, and all who were slain by her were strong men. Now she didn't. She wasn't a mass murderer, you know, and using her sexual appeal to kill people. That wasn't what was happening. But the slain is a little bit different here. It's a slain by letting the desires of your flesh control you. And they're all who were slain by her were strong men. Why not weak men? Maybe the weak men know their weakness, and they weren't that close to this woman. I'm going to go on the other block. I don't want to even walk by her house. I'm afraid of myself. I know what I'm capable of. I don't want to flirt with any danger. I don't want to give the devil an opportunity. I don't want to make any provision for my flesh because it's bad. But the strong men are vulnerable. It won't affect me. I can handle it. I would never do that. All who slain by her were strong men. Her house is the way to hell, descending to the chambers of death. When you give yourself over to lusts of the flesh, you're dead while you're alive. Because you're not really living. See, it's not like, you know, I'm going to preach real hard against this sin, stop it. You know, I'm going to pound the pulpit and try to get some sense into people to stop sinning because it's wrong and evil. I want to tell you right now, if you do it, you're stupid and you're going to hurt yourself. So I'll put it that way. And I don't want to see you do that. I want to see you go the right path because God's way is best. I would be so stupid to commit a sexual sin. I thank God, you know, when it's a single man and I had some opportunities, and thank God the Lord gave me strength to get out, to run. As a married man, I thank God He's kept me. I want to be kept. I pray, God, I want to just get through this life unscathed by this sin that is so prevalent in society. God, keep me, help me. And I'll tell you, through many dangers and many, you know, temptations, you need God's strength. You need help. We all do. But boy, I tell you, the joy of having a clean conscience, of enjoying your mate, of knowing what God is doing in the lives of people and just how God can use you, it far outweighs any temporary pleasure that would be mixed with so much guilt and shame. I just don't understand. Well, I do understand because I see the temptation in my own life. It's as much as I know, I still feel that lure. And I have to realize, God, I need your strength. Men, if you're struggling with pornography, don't call it a struggle anymore. It's a sin. Put it away. Women, if you're tempted in these areas, put it away. Put things away that are stumbling you and causing you to fantasize more about some romantic thing that your husband isn't providing. Let your wife, let your husband satisfy you. If you're single, trust the Lord. He knows your needs. And his plan is so much better. And in the end, it's awesome. In the end, there's no shame. In the end, you don't have to hide.